Hey, now that we've covered action films, let's talk about disaster. Now, first of all, depending on how you define things, let me say that the distinction between action and disaster is at times very small. And at a lot of times, it has to do with the marketing of the film more than the film itself. So, for instance, Steven Spielberg's Jaws was originally marketed as a disaster movie. However, when the first reviews of the film came in from the critics were all calling it an action movie. So the marketers changed their strategy and they started calling Jaws an action movie, and some people have suggested that this helped the success of the film. We'll never know how much Jaws might have made as a disaster movie, but it is, I think, an important historical fact that shows us how arbitrary the distinction between action and disaster can be. But that said, there are some very key differences in terms of frameworks, and that's what we want to get into in this session. So, what are disasters all about? What distinguishes them at their core from the action genre, if anything? And what are the frameworks of the disaster genre? Well, I think there are quite a number. Typically, to begin, a disaster film presents us with a state of normalcy, which then erupts in images of wide-scale, if not total, death. And, you know, action movies do not need to do that. They can be tremendously localized. And so in the disaster movie, it's not really enough for a few people to come under threat, or just the hero or the hero and his family to come under threat. The masses have to come under threat. And if not, the entire human population, whenever possible. And I think that it's really important that the masses are the human masses. We don't really have a whole lot of disaster movies about the extinction of cows or chickens or some kind of endangered species or what have you. We like to watch movies in which humans come under threat. And this isn't to say that the environment and all God's creatures can't also come under attack, but the focus obviously needs to be on the human. We want to be able to identify with the thing that's coming under attack or in danger of being destroyed. And for reasons I'll talk about, we actually get a great deal of pleasure from those humans actually being destroyed. So I want to go over a number of basic types of disaster movies, and there's going to be some overlap between them, and in many cases overlap with different genres. But I think these categories of the disaster movie are very useful types that help us understand the frameworks of the disaster genre in greater depth. And the first is this idea of natural attack. So natural attack, and this is what Jaws used to be considered before they turned it into an action movie. And it's really nature versus nature in many ways. Jaws is about a human community fighting against a destructive force found out in the ocean. And really, it's a giant shark that has nothing better to do than hunt and eat humans all day. And so it's not just a natural threat, but it's a normal threat. It's a threat that actually is out there in some degree. In different disaster movies, normal threats have included things like sharks, rats, birds, ants, snakes, frogs, etc. But it doesn't have to be a normal threat. You can also have an abnormal threat that comes from nature. And an abnormal threat occurs when some kind of radioactive or chemical force or atomic force mutates something in nature, which then threatens humans. So I'm thinking about movies like Them, which represents, you know, an abnormal form of natural attack with some sort of nuclear radiation involved. You can also have giants, you know, giants in the form of natural monsters, giant bees, giant lizards, and so forth. And as far as I know, there's no real reason why King Kong is so big. He just is. So I'll leave it up to you to decide whether there's something normal about King Kong. But certainly the point being is that in the disaster movie, it can actually come from something as it exists in nature, or it could be stimulated by something like nuclear disasters or mishaps or chemical changes in the environment that cause the animals to shift, mutate, and otherwise cause havoc on the earth. Now, there are, of course, fantasy threats that stem from nature as well, Godzilla being a most famous example. And it's probably important to point out that Godzilla is a mixture of the normal and the abnormal, given the obvious reference to creatures that actually exist, and the reference to nuclear weaponry, and, you know, Godzilla is also symbolic of certain tensions between the US and Japan following the Second World War. And so you can think about ways to maybe create disaster movies that rely upon history. And if you think about a movie like District 9, there are certain historical elements in that film that relate to what was going on in Godzilla when they created that. And it's worth pointing out here, thinking back to what we said about the crime genre, is that we have the possibility for social commentary to be at work in the disaster film. Okay, so another form of natural disaster can include the elements. So we got hurricanes, floods, volcanoes, earthquakes. All these forms of natural threat attack not only people, but houses and buildings, highways, and other systems of transit like planes and trains and maybe some sort of underground tunnel systems. And you also have attacks on the technology that we have, like our communication systems, such as TV and radio towers. And writing this kind of story actually lets you criticize what it comes down to is our reliance on the comforts of the modern world. And the thematic framework beyond criticizing the comforts of the modern world is you also get a chance to show how easily things fall apart, how futile all the human effort that has gone into creating these things can just be toppled over within seconds. And, you know, you can criticize what happens when we can't get information in the ways that we're used to, or we can't travel or go shopping, etc. Now, what goes along with this is that you also get to show how terrible it is not to have those things, or criticize how superficial we are when we lose these comforts of the modern world. But you also get to create a fantasy of renewal. And you can satisfy this deep desire we humans often have to tear everything down and start all over again. And if you don't think that need is important, well, there's a little book called the Bible, and one of the most famous stories in the Bible is when God sees that humans have abused their privileges, he takes it all away. He destroys it with a flood. And one of the powers of that story is that we get to start fresh again, and things are clean and pure and brand new. And also, metaphorically, the sin has been washed away as well. The soul has been cleansed, not just the people and the parts of the earth. It's actually the inner part of the humanity has been cleaned as well. And so the story of the flood has been a favorite story for a very, very long time. And it was, in fact, a part of the Gilgamesh narrative and other Babylonian myths long before it appeared in the Bible. So humans have been telling it for a while. And, of course, we have had recently in the cinema, a few years back now, but 2012. And that, of course, used the flood in a pretty interesting way. So by writing this kind of disaster film, you get to create a fantasy that we all cherish, primarily because we get to think about starting over and having a fresh new beginning. And, you know, it's ideally one where we're not bothered by the mistakes of our past and its ugly architecture. And I don't necessarily literally mean the architecture of our buildings, but also the ugly ugly architecture of the sins lurking in our souls. So to sum up this part, in all of these different kinds of natural attack, disaster films are attempting to dramatize human helplessness against forces of nature, and that's a very important framework. In the case of movies about atomic disasters or films where radiation or atomic energy has mutated a natural creature and turned that creature into an abnormal threat, what we're seeing is that humans are being diminished, not by the nature that has been changed, but by the results of their own technology. So it isn't just that nature is attacking us, but what we're seeing is the results of our own irresponsibility with what we've created. So, also a point that needs to be drawn out is that with these normal attacks, we can see that small familiar creatures become threatening. And that's quite exciting to explore. So in Hitchcock's The Birds, for example, power is given to tiny, tiny creatures we would normally never fear. At most, they're the nuisance that bangs into our window once in a while. And part of that fear, I think, is very important in The Birds, is that we're just never given a logical reason for why the birds are behaving in this way. And we don't know why Jaws has nothing better to do than hunt humans. So the framework point here is that these films are attributing will and mind and purpose and a kind of collective power, really, in the case of the birds, to creatures that we normally consider safe, or creatures that in any case that would not normally endanger us unless we were out looking for trouble, like the crocodile hunter or something like that. So that covers natural disasters. The next category doesn't really have a name, but it involves vehicles, and usually vehicles in motion. So you can have disaster movies involving flying, and of course, disaster films with flying are typically based on the audience's familiar sense of insecurity when we get into a plane. And you also have a kind of mythological notion here of being punished for even daring to fly. And this goes back to the myth of Icarus, where the absolute human, how shall we say it? The human confidence in being able to defy the laws of nature is something that comes back to haunt us and punish us. Now, if we don't happen to be flying in one of these vehicle movies, then we might be floating instead, and Titanic is a good example. Titanic is, of course, one of those examples of multiple genres going on at once. It's action, drama, romance, and there are strong elements of social criticism in that film. And of course, it is inherently a historical period piece. I won't get into it here, but if you're interested, you need to hear Slavoj Žižek's interpretation of Titanic, which you can look up on YouTube. Just put Zizek and the word Titanic into YouTube and it will come up. He has a very, very unique take on what's going on in that film. Oh, hell, let's just talk about it. Basically, what he suggests, and it's quite interesting, is that he suggests that it's a relief for the female protagonist when Jack dies. And he evidences this by pointing out a scene at the end where the two, Rose and Jack, are frozen on a piece of wood, and he's going to essentially sink her if she doesn't let him go. And what Zizek points out is that when she's unclasping him from holding onto that piece of wood with her, she kind of pushes him away, and there's almost a sense of relief in her face. And that's kind of a strange interpretation, because it does seem like the most tragic moment in the whole film. Not that the boat sinks, but that they have their these true loves have to be separated. But what Zizek is getting at, and I think it's really interesting, that maybe will prompt some ideas in your minds for storytelling, is that of course she's relieved at some level, because she was going to go get married to a poor guy who was an okay artist, and probably what was going to happen is they'd get a really, really small apartment in New York City, and she'd be pregnant for most of the rest of her fertile life. And after that, dealing with Jack the failed artist coming home drunk and being miserable all the time. So, of course, there's this sense of relief that she is pushing this guy away. A very cynical take on the underlying, well, framework of Titanic, but an interesting one nonetheless. So if you want to hear it from his mouth, Zizek is spelled Zizek, and I'm sure you can figure out how Titanic is spelled. YouTube is your friend. So continuing on with vehicles in disaster movies, there are ones where people travel underground, such as The Core, and that's in an invented vehicle. Or you have disaster movies that involve cars. And for some reason, car disaster movies tend to be of the art house variety. So we have Godard's Weekend, which I highly recommend you see at some point in your life, or The Cars That Ate Paris, a very strange movie. There's kind of a disaster movie in Stephen King's Maximum Overdrive, although the disaster may be in the choice that he himself directed it. But yes, art house films seem to have an interest in cars. Cronenberg's Crash, based on the Ballard novel, has this quality of impending disaster having to do with cars, and the characters talk about this. Now, another major category here, another major framework, is the disaster movie in which an entire city starts to break down. And now the city that fails can be connected with a natural disaster like an earthquake or a volcano. And all of these show the city falling apart because of a natural disaster, but the city can also fall apart because of a monster's attack, Beast from Beyond, Godzilla, and so forth. Or the city could fall apart from a bacteria or virus. Now, whereas monsters and volcanoes always involve death from some sort of inexplicable mixing of nature and timing and sometimes what seems like fate, as if the gods or God had said the time to pop is now, bacteria and viruses very, very specifically dehumanize the humans. So we see people sick and dealing with their illness within the architecture and the institutions of the failing city, the police, the hospitals, the schools, even the prisons. And seeing them weakened in this way is tremendously moving. Moving on, another framework in the disaster movie area is the notion of survival. And most disaster movies are ultimately stories of survival, but some concentrate on survival more than others. Robinson Crusoe, he has to survive after his shipwreck. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been a story. There wouldn't have been anyone to live through what he recorded. You could have a family who has to survive on the road after a nuclear attack, as happens in Panic in the Year Zero, a very interesting film. You also have survival movies that are about human perseverance, both psychological and physical. So there's that ability to overcome a threat. When there's really no logical reason for why that threat is there in the first place, it becomes even more interesting. And that's a difference between disaster movies and action movies, is that action films almost always have a clear reason for why something happens. If a guy's going to be jumping up and down and punching and fighting and kicking and commandeering helicopters and so forth, you need a reason for why all of this is happening. Someone's kidnapped an ex-military agent's daughter or what have you. But disaster movies get to be absurd. They're not Waiting for Godot by Samuel Beckett, right? But they do concentrate on how humans deal with the absurd, just events over which we have no control. And that's a very fascinating part of the framework of the disaster genre. Now, another category is time, when the disaster movie takes place. So you could have it set place in the past or in the future. You could have Pompeii, which would be a natural disaster film, or it could be like Planet of the Apes in the future, or more specifically, you could have a disaster film like the Terminator series, in which the present moment is always connected to future events. Everything that's happening now is going to be responsible for the way the future plays out. And because of the way the logic of this story works, we always know that there's nothing the characters can do to stop the coming nuclear disaster. And that's a really fascinating kind of thing. We know that they may or may not be able to engage in certain activities after the disaster, but we know the disaster is coming. We always know throughout that story that many, many, many people are going to die. Okay, so that's quite a number of different kinds of disaster film. Let's now talk about some of the different conventions you can use. One of the main things that disaster movies try to do is aim for impact and immediacy. So you want to give the illusion that things are happening right now. Now, you want to do that in film in general, but here the desire for the feeling of immediacy really means like no backstory, you know? And also, immediacy can be created with connecting it to what's actually going on in the world. So I think Orson Welles really sparked this in a big way when he was doing his radio show War of the Worlds, and everyone believed that the broadcast was real. So there's opportunities there to think about that in terms of like pre-visualizing what the angle of advertising the story you're working on might be. That could be inspiring. Now, disaster movies try to capture the feeling of immediacy also to create terror. Now, George Romero's Night of the Living Dead is only related to the disaster film. It belongs to horror, but it's a good example of this kind of immediacy that you want. There's a good reason why he chooses to have the young woman trapped in a car at the beginning of the movie when we first meet the zombies, and this is because he knew that his primary audience was going to be young people at the drive-in theaters. The viewers themselves would be in their cars, and so by having the first zombie attack in the film take place while a pretty young woman is trapped in a car, well, you get that sense of immediacy and threat, and this is what I'm talking about. So another kind of idea to think about is the context, and I think that it remains to happen that people are sitting in a movie theater during a disaster, and that would be a pretty spooky scene to sit through. Now, another framework to think about is the role of hope in the disaster film. We know that terrible things are going to happen, and we know that it's highly likely that most of the victims will not survive. So in Titanic, you know, we know that the old lady is going to survive. She has to in order to tell the tale as it was set up in the frame. But at no other moment in the film are we given hope that everyone can be rescued. We know that just about everyone is going to die. And this, of course, gets into the certainty of wide-scale death, and it's one of the pleasures offered by the disaster genre. It's a very anxious pleasure, but a pleasure nonetheless. And I would encourage to think back to the biblical story of the flood and think about what's really going on there in terms of pleasing us somehow that this is taking place. Now, another thing that disaster movies tend to do is offer a cross-section of society. It's one of the major frameworks of this particular genre. So you get to see white people, black people, Asian people, poor people, rich people, men, women, children, and so forth. And the reason why you want to do this is to give the fullest possible sense that all of society is under threat. It's not going to be good enough if it's just one type of person. Another framework element we often see in disaster films is the role of gambling or chance, which is to say life is a gamble. You can be in the wrong place at the wrong time. And in disaster movies, they'll often pull this string, right? A character is supposed to be doing one thing and they wind up in another place that puts them into harm's way. And often, this is maybe not the main hero, but there'll be this one pathetic and very petty character who won't accept the situation. And by not accepting the situation, will actually put other characters at increased risk in order to save themselves. And that character not only ends up getting wiped out in a very unhappy way, but that character symbolizes the pettiness that humans sometimes lower themselves to in order to avoid their own doom. So that's a very important character to think about having. Another theme we sometimes see in the overall framework of the disaster genre is isolation. Being cut off from others in the throes of a disaster is perhaps quite untapped. The idea of being cut off from the rest of the world with no possibility of help from the outside is an extraordinary possibility, I think, that needs greater exploration. There was an interesting movie. It wasn't a disaster movie per se, but Rodrigo Cortez had done a movie called Buried, starring Ryan Reynolds, and the whole movie takes place while a guy is in a box under the ground. Now, there wasn't a disaster going on outside. Actually, it really was a kind of disaster. It was making a strong reference to America's wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So there was a kind of disaster going on out there. It's just not the kind that we're talking about. But when you think about it, most films, disaster films and other films included, rely on a really very well-developed sense of society, either literally or metaphorically implied. But in the disaster movie, society is seen as something easily disrupted and fractured, and we can see not only how easily society can abandon us, but we can see the extent to which society perhaps never really helped us in the first place. And that's an element of the social critique that again speaks to audiences because we have this fantasy of renewal. But what's less seen is how easily society can abandon us to the point that we are watching that as a point of dramatic tension, as something that people have to struggle with. So, something to think about. You could also have two isolated groups rather than just one, and the disaster forces the two groups to unite together for a common cause. And this is basically the framework of Jaws. In Jaws, in most of the cases I've been mentioning as well, the disaster movie tends to give us a sense that savagery still exists in our civilization. So often in these films, the disaster element leads to a kind of lawlessness, and the humans lower themselves in order to survive. I mean, disaster literally de-civilizes us, dividing us from civility, which is, you know, kind of on the surface anyway. But one of the interesting sort of figures that we need to think about before carrying on is the one who fights this disordering of groups that we see developing. And this is the recurring figure of the specialist. And the specialist is the guy, he's a scientist, or perhaps he's someone who has survived a similar disaster before, or just anyone with deep insight into the disaster. They may not even have the right insight, but they've got some kind of insight. So maybe they read, they interpreted the Bible in a particular way and whatnot, and they can do the job of explaining for us what's going on. Or in the case of a scientist, this person can provide a factual basis for the problem. But the important thing is that no matter how many explanations these different people are able to give, they have no means of control. So although the specialist may offer explanations, the disaster only really seems stronger because the authority figure cannot control it. They may offer that element of hope, but we learn just how strong the problem is by seeing how weak the source of authority is. So I'll say that again because it's a very, very important framework point. We learn just how strong the problem is by seeing how weak the source of authority is. And this goes for civilization as well. If the specialist represents the height of civilization, having gained all this knowledge in the case of a scientist, but yet has no power to control it, then we're really seeing another kind of social critique. Let me mention just two more framework points that I think are useful to think about if you were to embark on a script in this area of genre. If a disaster movie has a romantic subplot, then what you get is an interesting kind of conflict, one in which the hero has to decide not only how do I protect myself, but how do I protect other people at the same time. And that can be dealt with in a very cliche way, but it can be really complicated and dramatic and very thrilling to watch that problem. Finally, I think a major point that needs to be taken into account when we're talking about disaster movies and its general framework is that in disaster films, the good people die along with the bad. And that, of course, is the case in Titanic, which is based on a true story, but also in fantasy ones like Deep Impact, for instance, which is basically a science fiction disaster movie. But the point being is that the disaster is a tremendously equalizing event. And outside of drama or dramatic tragedy, the disaster film is really one of the few places where it's still acceptable for the hero to die along with the villain. And the hero still gets to be heroic. Unless you're one of these hardline philosophers like Slavoj Žižek I was mentioning earlier, who thinks that perhaps it was a blessing for Rose to get rid of Jack at the end of Titanic. Now, on the matter of the hero being able to die, you know, think, in an action movie, the big budget actor is rarely allowed to die, but in disaster films, the mortality rate of famous movie stars is the highest in all of cinema, and that's a very interesting phenomena indeed. So, realizing these elements can be very, very freeing to someone who wants to work on this kind of project, and I hope you'll let me know if you do.